Dear one, the world is waiting for the sunrise. Every rose is covered with you.
Joyous music for you this morning. It's The World is Waiting for the Sunrise, as performed by Les Paul and his then-wife, Mary Ford, live on The Ed Sullivan Show way back in 1951. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Larry Mueller today. He returns tomorrow for Garden Talk. But on our show today, you're going to be hearing more music by Les Paul as we talk about his life, his legend, and his legacy. Our guest, Sue Baker. She's the program director at the Les Paul Foundation. And as we talk with Sue, we want you to be a part of our conversation. Who are your favorite guitar players? And perhaps, arguably, Sue would be able to find a connection from them all the way back to Les Paul. Or do you have questions about the music industry and how Les Paul played a central role in it and continues to do so in many ways today? Join our conversation about this Wisconsin legend, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email anytime, talk@WPR.org. And Sue Baker, welcome to the Larry Mueller Show.
Well, thank you, Lee. It's good to be here.
So for those who are perhaps not guitar players, or for those who are not recording artists, how would you explain who Les Paul is and what his revolutionary understanding of music means to our sound that we hear today?
Well, probably the lead guitarist that most of us know would be the best affirmation of what Les did. As you had mentioned early on, he not only is known for his relationship to the Gibson Les Paul guitar, but he also revolutionized recording, and that is the key piece for musicians. I mean, Les did things like, well, his most important might be sound on sound, which is layering, and you heard Mary in the song that you played at the beginning, where it sounds like there's several women singing, but it's actually Mary, and it was a matter of Les recording her several different times and putting it all together.
Yeah, the advent of multi-track recording, which every musical artist uses to some degree today, and as music has moved from the music studio in many ways to the computers in our own bedroom, it's what people are using right now on their own Macs and laptops.
Absolutely, and that's thanks to Les Paul.
It's just amazing when you think about it, but that's just only one of the things he did. And I suppose I was not surprised, Sue Baker, to learn that Les Paul is the only person to be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and the National Inventors Hall of Fame.
And that pretty much, if you have to encapsulate who was Les Paul, that is probably the quickest way of saying it.
Yes, absolutely. So what is the role that Wisconsin plays in the development of Les Paul?
Well, he was born in Waukesha and grew up in Waukesha. And I got to know Les only the last 10 years of his life, and we became really good friends. And I will interject that he was a fantastic storyteller, and I was his sponge. I just took it all in. So Les said to me that the reason he is buried in Waukesha is because he said when he was growing up, the people of Waukesha, he said, they were always there for me. They were always supporting me. They encouraged me. He said, my teachers kept encouraging me too. And it was actually in Waukesha where Les started his inventions. He did his first invention, which is the flippable harmonica holder. In the 1920s, there were harmonica holders for musicians who wanted to play the harmonica and play a guitar as well, but they wouldn't flip, and Les wanted to play both sides. So he invented the flippable harmonica holder. It was very primitive, not, the sleek ones we see musicians using now, but his was the first flippable one. And he was all of 13. I mean, it's amazing.
13 years old, and he's starting with his first inventions, but he's also starting, and, I think he became best known as an incredible jazz guitarist, but he starts out as a country and Western musician.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. He was known, when he was growing up, he was known as Red Hot Red. And then when he was an older teen and started touring the country, he was known as Rhubarb Bread, and those are all funny stories as to how he got those names. And it was only when he was in Chicago in his 20s, jazz was a big thing in the south side of Chicago. Les was working at WGN Radio and WBBM, and then at night he would go down to the south side of Chicago and learn from all the jazz greats. So that's where he picked it up. And of course, that was his signature sound, is jazz and his twist on it, the popular tunes that he did.
Sue Baker, our guest, she is the program director at the Les Paul Foundation, looking at the life and legacy of Les Paul from Waukesha. And if you have questions about Les Paul's life or how his legacy continues today, you can join us at 800-642-1234 or talk at WPR.org. So Les Paul was not his real name, Sue. where did Les Paul come from among all his other AKAs? And who did what was his name for real?
Well, his real name, and this, everyone will understand why he changed it, was Lester Polsvis. And yeah, a little mouthful. There was three S's. It's P-O-L-S-F-U-S-S. Well, the funny story about his last name is his mother hated all those S's. So by the time Les was even in elementary school, she had informally dropped that last S. And then she dropped the middle S, and there is a hilarious TV segment of Les being on a talk show in the 50s, and he's explaining how his mother kept changing his last name, and he said, at the rate she's going, my last name's going to be...
Well, we settled on Les Paul.
So Les, he was a comedian. He actually... studied under Jackie Gleason for a while. He thought that maybe he'd give up music and just be a comedian.
I never thought of Les Paul as a funny guy or as a, you know, as you knew him, Sue, as a great storyteller.
Oh, he was. In fact, at the Iridium Jazz Club in New York, and that's where Les performed every Monday night up until 3 months before he died. But, I'm sorry, 2 months. But at any rate, he would... If someone would come up on stage, and he often invited people up on stage, and if they started telling jokes, he usually would say, hey, I'll do the funny stuff.
And as you mentioned, he was active late into his life, and I believe he even earned a couple of Grammys at the age of 90.
Yes. Yes, he did. And that was for a recording that a whole, well, not an album, but a, you know, it was a CD, but he recorded with many of the top known musicians of the day. And yeah, he got Grammys for those.
So that was way back in 2006. When did the Les Paul Foundation get established, Sue?
Well, Les actually quietly established it quite a few decades ago. But I remember talking to him about it and asking him, and he said, well, you know, it's designed to stay dormant until I pass. So Les took his entire estate and put it into the foundation.
Wow. I didn't know that.
And I had
a
wonderful conversation with him and said, Les, tell me your vision. What do you want done with your foundation? And he said to me, well, you know about my childhood more than most people. And he said, you know, I had a hard time. I want you to find kids who really would like to play the guitar, but they're in compromised financial situations. He said, you take my money and you help those kids. You get guitars to them. You get music lessons to them. And that's what we do today.
You mentioned earlier that he gave a lot of credit to Waukesha for supporting him and getting his start in music. But then you also talk about how when he started this foundation, he references some of the hard times he had as a child to break through musically. What were those hard times?
Well, Les was the second child of his parents, but his parents were divorced by the time he was five. And so he was being raised by a single mom. His dad still lived in Waukesha, but his parents really, really didn't get along. And his so it was difficult for Les to be able to spend time with his dad. Although, if you knew Les, you would know that he would make find a way to spend time with his dad. But his mom didn't have much money. You know, think about it. This was back in the 1920s. People didn't get divorced. And so here was this young kid going to school, and his parents were divorced. And his dad was a bit of a carouser, a gambler, a womanizer. and that had a reflect on Les. I can only imagine that he got teased in school.
Yeah.
And his mom had to be economically aggressive. So she actually was running a cab company, a taxi company. In the 1920s, what woman does that stuff, you know? and she was very outspoken. She believed in communism.
Whoa.
She went to communist meetings in Waukesha. So he had a different childhood than a lot of people.
According to the Wikipedia page for Les Paul, his mom was related to the founders of Blatt's Brewing.
Yes, that's correct.
Wow.
And the Stutz Automobile Company. Her last name was Stutz.
How did Les then end up picking up the guitar?
Well, he started with the piano.
Okay.
And he went to lessons, and there's a story, and Les had shared this with me, that he said, I thought I was playing really well. And he said, one day my piano teacher pinned a note to my shirt and sent me home. And he said, I was sure that note was going to tell my mom what a great job I was doing with the piano, because he said, I could play anything. And so he got home, and his mother unpinned the note from his shirt and read it.
No.
And immediately tore it up.
Oh.
And Les said, what? And she said, don't listen to your teacher. She thinks you can't play piano. You're going to be great, Les.
Oh.
Yeah. So then his brother had, I think it was a trombone. He didn't like that. And his mother kept saying, that's no good, Les, because you got to be able to talk to the audience. You can't have any instrument that's around your mouth. She was the real, you know,
wow,
Hollywood mom, if you would.
Yeah.
Back in the 20s, she was pushing Les all the time. So he tried several things, and then he had a newspaper route and saved up his money and got what he called his cheapy guitar and started playing that. And he tells a funny story that he had just, it was, of course, mail order. You know, Sears used to be the Amazon of the 20s and 50s.
So this was a Sears Roebuck guitar.
Yes. Real inexpensive,
$5
or something like that.
Nylon
so
strings and, yeah.
Yep. He talked about how he opened the box, and as he opened the box, his finger accidentally hit one of the strings. And from the kitchen, his mother yells out, she always called him Lester. Lester, you sound great already. Yeah, she was the ultimate supportive woman. And in fact, Les always said there were two women that were most important in his life. The first one was his mother, and the second was Mary.
Mary Ford, his wife, who you heard at the outset of the start of our conversation from the Ed Sullivan Show. Sue, I just think you're so very fortunate to have been able to know Les Paul, to be able to just be in the room with Les Paul, let alone become to some degree his confidant, and then to take over this foundation. It feels like a humbling responsibility. What does the relationship between Les Paul and the foundation and its work today mean to you?
Well, I think I need to clarify. I don't run the foundation. I'm just the
program director. I apologize.
We do have a small organization, a tightly committed group of people, and then we have other people that help us. But basically, we're living out what Les had directed us to do. We're sharing his legacy as a way to inspire other people. I mean, and Les and I had several conversations about this, that in most people, and I would dare to say everybody, there's that scared little insecure child in each of us. Hmm. You know, as adults, we put on this self-confident front, but deep inside, there's that scared little kid.
I have no idea what you're talking about. None.
Oh, yeah, right. So, and you know, when you really get to know people, and I don't care how famous or important they are, it's still there. Mm. And led by example, he went through so many challenges throughout his life, and yet he kept going, and he kept going, no matter how big the challenge was. And that's what's so important, is to empower everybody around us so that they can all become the best that they're capable of becoming. And that's the guiding light for us within the foundation.
Sue Baker is the program director at the Les Paul Foundation. We're taking a look at the life of Les Paul and how that legacy continues today, in part through the foundation and in part through the music and the recordings that you listen to each and every day, including right here on WPR. We invite you to share your stories of your favorite guitarists, or if you've ever owned a Les Paul guitar of your own, or two or maybe three, tell us about it. 800-642-1234. What is it that makes a Gibson Les Paul guitar so cherished? 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org. Our conversation with Sue Baker continues here on The Larry Mueller Show on WPR News. Coming up after noon today, we'll hear how an Eagles cover band from Wisconsin is replicating the band experience without you having to go all the way to Las Vegas to have it. Then we'll also get a glimpse into the songwriting process of folk singer Lou Ray from Eau Claire. But right now, our conversation is with Sue Baker, the program director at the Les Paul Foundation. And if you have a question about Les Paul, there is nobody better to ask than our guest. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@WPR.org. And Sue, I want to ask you about going back to some of the inventions as he is developing as a guitarist. And it's 1940, way back in 1940, when he first builds the log. What was the log?
Well, we have to go back further than that. Oh. We actually have to go back to Waukesha to the 1930s, where Les was performing as he was getting paid tips at a barbecue stand. And when he was playing his little acoustic cheapy guitar, he didn't like how the box part of the guitar vibrated. He said, "I want to hear just the strings and nothing else." I'm going to shorten the story because it gets kind of long, but He wanted to find the most dense material he could find. And he said, "You know what? It was a piece of railroad, the rail, yeah. Not the track, but the steel." And he lived, fortunately for him, across the street from a railroad track. So he said to me, "So I got my buddies and we borrowed a wagon." And by that time I knew Les well enough. And I said, "Les, you borrowed the wagon?" And he said, "Well, I returned it. Does that count?" So he borrowed the wagon. He had his six friends go down, and it's a very steep embankment to the Fox River where the train track was. And they underneath the bridge, there were pieces of rail that the railroad company would come by, and they'd check the rail. And if there was a flaw, they'd cut it out and throw it under the bridge. And he said, "I got my buddies," and they picked up a 2-foot piece of rail, and they put it in the wagon, and they took it up the embankment and took it over to my house. And I said, "Whoa, Les. Wait a minute, your idea, your buddies, the wagon, where are you in all of this?" And he said, "Well, somebody had to manage it." So he takes a piece of rail and he puts a guitar string over the top of it. And he puts a spike from the railroad underneath the string to hold it up. And he puts a magnet underneath and speaker from his mother's candlestick telephone. And he said he plucked a string, and he said it was just the sound I wanted to hear. He said it had the sustain. It was a crisp sound, and nothing else was vibrating. He said that had so much sustain, you could go out and get a sandwich and come back, and it'd still be going.
Which, now, I mean, that did not happen prior to what was this rail guitar that he'd built.
Yeah, that was where it started. And for all the listeners in Wisconsin, all of us are so lucky because you can go to Milwaukee's Discovery World and there is a recreation of the rail, and it's in a acrylic box, but there's a hole where you can stick your finger in there and pluck that string and listen to the sustain.
I had no idea that was there. Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah. And that was done under Les's guidance. So Les did that, and that was in the 30s. And then he started his career, and he, you know, moved all over and did all kinds of things. And then in New York in the 1940s, for that 10-year stretch, he had been thinking about that wonderful sound on the rail.
Mm-hmm.
And so on Sundays, he convinced the Evinrude factory to let him use their tools and you know, experiment in their factory on Sundays. And that is where he created the law. He knew the rail was too heavy to be practical, so he took the 4x4 and strung it the same way. But he was a little more sophisticated by that time. He said he took the rail, now I'm sorry, the log, and if you know what the log looks like, think about just this 4x4 strung with guitar strings and just that. So he took that to a club and he played it and he said, "Oh, it sounded so wonderful." But he said the audience was neutral. They didn't respond. And he said, I could not figure out why they weren't hearing what I was hearing. And so he went back to the Evinrude factory, and he took an old acoustic guitar. He sawed it in half, and he put what he called the wings on each side of his log so that it looked a little bit more like a guitar.
Yeah. And all of a sudden, you start to see the beginnings of the Les Paul guitar that we all know, that guitarists all know today.
Absolutely. So we took the log with the wings back to the same club, played the same song, and he said people went wild. And he said, "What's that instrument? That is so cool. The sound is so great." And Les said, "That's when I realized people hear with their eyes."
Huh. Wow.
Yeah. And it took him another 10 years to convince Gibson to build the Les Paul solid body electric guitar. So there is persistence for you.
Sue Baker is the program director of the Les Paul Foundation, taking a look at his life and legacy today along with you. Go to your questions now and your experiences. If you've ever met Les Paul or have a Les Paul story to share or a Les Paul guitar of your own, 800-642-1234 or talk at WPR.org. Audrey in Madison, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hello, this is a wonderful story. My husband and I, he was a guitarist. He had a Les Paul guitar, which now our grandson in California has, very proudly.
Yeah.
But we heard Les Paul play at the Iridium, and my husband went up and talked to him, and they kind of shared Wisconsin tales, whatever. And he was so warm, and we met his son, and it was just a fabulous experience.
Oh, that is wonderful, Audrey. Did you have a question for Sue Baker about Les?
No. Oh, I did. Did he play by ear?
Thank you for the story, Audrey, and the question. Sue, how did Les Paul learn music?
Well, like I had said earlier, he did take piano lessons, but for the most part, he never learned to read music. He did play by ear.
Well, that's considering how intricate his playing became, the very pointed solos, guitar solos, it's almost incredible to think that that was all by his ear, especially when you tell us the story about how he learned the hard way that we hear by sight.
Yep.
Molly in La Crosse, we'll go to you next. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. So my story begins back in 2008, I think it was, where I was in a book signing line to meet Les Paul and have him sign one of his books that he, you know, obviously published. And so he wasn't signing any memorabilia or anything like that, no other, like, guitars or anything. So it's my turn in line. I asked Paul, I'm like, "Hey, Les Paul, can you sign my arm?" And he was like, "I don't think so." You know, he was 90-something years old, and he's like, "No, you know." And I'm like, "Please, Les." And I had a tattoo. I have a tattoo of a woman playing a guitar, Les Paul guitar.
Oh.
And I said, "Les, this is your girl. Les, you've got to sign my arm. Please, Les Paul, sign my arm. Please, please." And so he did. He finally caved in and signed my arm after much waiting, you know. And so immediately after that, I ran to my tattoo shop and I sat for hours. My tattoo shop guy was like, "Don't you have anything to do today?" I'm like, "Not today," because it was summer and it was starting to wear off. And I'm like, "I can't lose this tattoo." Like, I can't lose this marker before it's tattooed. So the next day I had tickets to see him at, I think it was at the Pabst Theater. Mm-hmm. And so I was in the way nosebleeds, and I'm just like enjoying the show, uh-huh. a bunch of celebrities. It's his birthday bash. And so I'm at the bar getting a drink, and someone's like, "Oh, that's really cool. You should get that tattoo, that signature." And I said, "Well, actually it is. I went yesterday." And they're like, "Oh, that's so cool." So at the end of the show, I'm heading out, and one of the security guards grabs my attention and was like, "You need to come with me." And I'm like, uh-oh.
What did I do?
What did I do? Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm like, okay. So I go with him. I'm scared. And I'm like, what did I do wrong? And he escorts me into a room with everybody with VIP badges on.
Oh, wow.
And there I am, like, no VIP badge, just this young woman, you know. And I'm like, okay, what's going on? And I see Les Paul sitting at a table. They wheel out a birthday cake, and we all start singing "Happy Birthday" to Les Paul. So there I am, joining the crowd, miss nobody, in the middle of an audience with Les Paul on his what would be his last birthday, I believe.
Oh, Molly, that is amazing, and I do believe you have a backstage pass tattooed on your arm now for good.
Right? That's so awesome. When he passed, I hate to say it, but my friend was like, "Your arm just went up in value."
Molly, what a wonderful story, and thank you so much for calling in and sharing that. Sue, were you perhaps around for that birthday celebration?
Yes, I was. And she described it very well. It was a wonderful celebration, and she was right. It was at the Pabst Theater, and they had the birthday cake. I mean, like I said, everything she said was spot on. I had a nice experience. My husband and I were at the book signing that preceded the big concert, and Les was thrilled to see us because by then I was a very good friend of his, and he enjoyed spending time with my husband, who was the techie guy. And Les decided that at the Pabst Theater, he wanted to have the stage set like a club, and so he instructed that there be high top tables.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I was told that my husband and I were to be on stage with Les. So, yes, I was there.
Oh, wow. Molly, thank you so much for the call. And Sue, an amazing experience. Let's go next to Joellen in Eau Claire. And I am curious to know, Joellen, would you be interested in selling?
Oh, well, I can't compete with that story. But I will say we had people interested in this guitar.
You have a Les Paul guitar?
Yes, and my mom had bought it for my dad's 40th birthday in 69 and surprised him with it, and that resulted in a bunch of guys playing in our basement all the time.
Oh, yeah.
And it was, once we had it evaluated, it's a TV model. I don't really know what that means, but it's a real gem, and people did try to offer to buy it, and of course, it's part of our family, and my daughter said there will be nobody buying this guitar.
Not for sale, but what kind of dollar figure were people figures were people throwing at you?
Well, I think we had it evaluated in Waukesha or someplace in the Midwest. I grew up in Milwaukee, and we just started getting contacts from China asking if it was for sale. So I don't know what the figure is, but we have it hidden away until people pull it out to play. They did say it should be played.
So then you can understand my opening question to you, and I understand your answer completely. But it becomes like a treasure. It becomes a jewel passed on from generation to generation because it is so priceless.
Absolutely. And just one quick note, Les Paul was about to appear in Waukesha years ago, and we had decided we'll take the guitar down and see if he would sign it.
Yeah.
And we didn't make it down in time, and he passed away within a week, I think. So we were sorry that we never got his signature.
Yeah. Well, you've got the guitar, Joellen, and if you're ever interested in selling it, you know you can look me up. But thank you for the story. Sue Baker, what is it that makes a Les Paul guitar a Les Paul guitar?
I'm really probably not the person to ask that question because I am not a techie person. I
I know Les's story, but I don't know all the technical stuff, and I'm not a guitar player, strange as that may seem. So
well,
that might be a bit out of my wheelhouse, but I do want to tie into something that she said earlier, and that was about a TV guitar. And I don't know for sure, but here's a piece of trivia that probably a lot of people don't know. We all are aware of TV reality shows, but do you know who did the first one?
No
way. Les Paul and Mary Ford.
What, the Les Paul and Mary Ford reality show? Like Big Brother?
Well, it was called the Les Paul and Mary Ford Show at Home, and it was in the 1920s, sponsored by Listerine. And there's clips on our website of it. And, I mean, they're wonderful. They're old black and white. It's from the 1950s. And, you know, anyone who knows about the 50s knows that the stereotypical view of husband and wife. And there's times where, you know, Mary's in the kitchen and saying, Les, I'm going to make some blueberry muffins. Let's sing a song. And then they break into the song. And the songs are wonderful. The storylines are just, you know, sort of typical 1952. You know, one of them's Mary's reading a book, and Les has cut out the last pages because she always cheated and read the last page of the book before finishing it. I mean, they're just wonderfully, wonderfully entertaining. But and there's so much people can learn about Les and listen to his music on the website, which is les-paul.com.
Les-paul.com, also a link up at wpr.org/Larry, but les-paul.com for the foundation and the videos you'll find with Les Paul and his then wife, Mary Ford. Was the Les Paul guitar a hit out of the box when Gibson released their first Les Paul guitars? How did they go over?
They were a hit. It was really good.
And so when did that first Gibson Les Paul come out? It was the early 50s?
Yes, 1952. That's the inaugural Gibson Les Paul solid body electric guitar.
The solid body electric guitar. And how has this guitar evolved or stayed the same over its iterations and over the decades, Sue?
Well, it's changed, you know, with styles and coloring. And at one point, Gibson changed it, and again, I'm not the guitar person,
right.
So I'm a little bit out of my wheelhouse, but they put, like, two horns on it, and Les did not like that, and so he insisted that Gibson change it back to the design Les liked.
When did you talk about it musically, like he's playing professionally during the day, he's learning jazz at night. When did he become the inventor? When did he get back to inventing these musical effects and recording techniques?
That happened. The recording techniques happened in his Hollywood garage. Les lived in Hollywood. Let me back up and give you kind of a timeline. He was born in Waukesha, and when he was 17, he got an offer to do a radio job in St. Louis. And keep in mind, this is in the middle of the Great Depression, and you know, people are in soup lines and all that other stuff. He gets offered for a solid job in St. Louis. He goes there. That radio station goes under. He goes to Springfield, Missouri, and then he gets a job offer in Chicago. So of course, he goes to Chicago. And he's performing there. He goes to New York, where he's playing with the Fred Waring Orchestra, which is another whole story. We don't have enough even years to talk about all this. But so he's in New York. And then Bing Crosby is the big guy. You know, he's all over the movie.
Sure.
He's singing. He has his radio show. And Les decides, I want to be like Bing Crosby, so I'm going to Hollywood. And that is why he moved to Hollywood, was to meet Bing Crosby. And again, that's another fun story, but I'm going to gloss over that so I can get to answer your question. So he goes to Hollywood, and he starts traveling with the Andrews sisters. And he's playing in Chicago, and his mom comes down from Waukesha to listen to Les. And she says to Les, oh, I heard you last night on the radio, Les. And Les said, Ma, you couldn't have heard me because I've been on stage with the Andrews sisters all the time. I'm not on the radio. And she said, huh, then you better figure out how to sound different than all those other people that are playing electric guitar. He quit his stint with the Andrews sisters.
Oh, wow.
Went back to Hollywood, locked himself in his garage, which he's already by that time turned into a recording studio, and starts experimenting. And it takes him 2 years. And that's when he comes up with overdubbing and phase shifting and all these other techniques that makes him sound so unique. And he introduces it with the song called Lover.
Lover. Actually, we have a little bit of Lover that we can play right now. Let's hear that. What? Whoa, Sue Baker, what is going on there? That is intense.
Isn't that amazing?
Yes.
And like all of the recording people and all of the musicians were reacting just the way you did. What is that? How did he do that? And it's all on his guitar. He did all kinds of things, and he recorded by, recording at normal speed and then playing back twice as fast.
Yes.
And he did all these maneuvers in his studio to get that very unique sound.
That is amazing. What were who were Les Paul's musical influences, Sue?
Well, Bing Crosby, because Bing knew how to market himself.
Interesting.
Django Reinhardt, who was a gypsy in France, and very well known by guitar players, was huge. Les was influenced by a lot of people. He was a very eager learner, and it wasn't just guitars and music. I remember distinctly one time when he came to the Waukesha County Historical Society and Museum when I was working there. And I was a director at that time, and I took him around showing and explaining things to him, and I took him into the research center where all the records are organized and easily accessible. And he said, Les Paul, at this time, and he's in his 90s, said to the archivist, I have a lot of papers in my house. Can you tell me how to organize them? The poor archivist. Eyes were as big as saucers, and he had a panic look on his face. And I said, Les, the archivist has a master's degree in library science. He can't tell you in a half an hour how to do all of that.
Some idea of how much there was in Les Paul's, to organize from Les Paul. Our guest, Sue Baker, is the program director at the Les Paul Foundation, and we invite you to this conversation about this Wisconsin legend. 800-642-1234. If you met the man or have stories about your favorite guitar player, we can tie it back to Les Paul, his creations, inventions, and revolutionary sound. 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org. Our conversation with Sue Baker continues here on WPR News.
Haven't felt like this, my dear, since I can't remember when. It's been a long, long time. You'll never know how many dreams.
That's Bing Crosby and Les Paul. You hear it there on The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today. He returns tomorrow for Garden Talk. Mark Dwyer will also be back to help care for our delicate plants as our winter arrives. And we'll talk about the best composting tomorrow, starting at 11 here on WPR News. Now, our guest, Sue Baker, the program director of the Les Paul Foundation, and we've taken a look at the life of Les Paul, but let's look at the legacy through this foundation, Sue Baker, and what the foundation is doing today. What kind of work do you do, and what kind of grants do you provide?
I would say that there's two main things. We have a comprehensive website, which I mentioned before, the les-paul.com, where people can find all kinds of things about Les, explore his inventions, listen to his music, great education page for a resource for teachers, but actually for anybody. There's fun things there. We try to make all the education very fun.
And your advisory board is a who's who of guitar players, by the way. That is amazing.
Yes, it is, indeed. The other thing is, and you mentioned the grants, we give grants to nonprofit organizations across the United States with a focus on helping people that are in economically compromised situations. And we have two deadlines. One is January 15th and the other is September 15th. And the form that people need to fill out is on our website under grants. And I think it's pretty straightforward. And it's a relatively easy application as long as people really answer all the questions.
And I also understand that the foundation is interested in focusing on hearing loss research.
Yes. Left head tinnitus, you know, the ringing in your ears, which anybody who has it really can drive you crazy.
Yep.
And most musicians have it because it's often caused by an exposure to noises that are too loud, as in loud music.
So, well, you can tell how long somebody's been on the radio by how loud their headphones are, Sue. So it's quite common in this business, too. And I think, yeah, to some degree, people can relate. And I find the research fascinating, and I think it would be very important.
We decided to really focus, to pinpoint our interest. And so we have been regularly, every year, we fund research for the cure, and we go through the Hearing Health Foundation because we know that in the Les Paul Foundation, we might be experts on Les Paul, but not on, on hearing research. So we work closely with them. And, you know, as with any research, you know, you keep trying and prying and you get little steps, but it's nothing that can happen quickly, but it's still there.
Granted.
I wanted to tie back into, you played Bing Crosby's song.
Yeah.
Bing Crosby had a little finger in, if you will, the sound-on-sound invention.
Really?
Because back during World War II, when the U.S. Armed Forces came back to the U.S. after the war, they brought back the reel-to-reel tape recorders that the Germans had invented. Because before that, in the U.S., we only had wire recorders. And Les knew that by that time he was good friends with Bing. He knew that Bing really didn't want to be in the studio doing his radio show. Bing wanted to be out on the golf course beating Bob Hope. So Les told Bing about this invention of the reel-to-reel tape recorder and said to Bing, this is something I think you'd really be interested in. Well, by that time, Bing had a lot of money, so Bing invested in Ampex, which, of course, created the first reel-to-reel tape recorders in the U.S., and as a gift to Bing, a gift from Bing to Les, he gave Les one of the first tape recorders.
Wow.
And then Les added another head to the tape recorder, and that was sound on sound.
All of a sudden, you're recording over yourself as many times as you like, and you can speed up the tape if you like or slow it down. And all of a sudden, the studio becomes magic, not this sterile room where whatever is captured is somehow replayed, but actually something that you can create sounds that you didn't even know existed, which he did by inventing sound effects that people still use today in music every day, like the flange.
Yes.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
We got a couple other questions here as we're running out of time, and I apologize, Sue, because we could do all day about Les Paul, but let's go to Matt in Sauk City. Matt in Sauk City. Good morning.
Hey there.
Hi.
My question was about pickups.
Yeah.
I was wondering how much Les did with guitar pickups. You know, did he try making his own? Did he try making different variations of them? I was just curious about that.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Interesting. Go ahead, Sue.
Absolutely. In fact, Les's son, Gene, talks about how that his dad would say, hey, I want you to do some more pickups. Go down in the basement and wind up some more pickups for me and make them this way or do this way. And so he was always having new pickups constantly.
And he's got his kid making them for him in the basement?
Yep.
And
Gene would have been in his teens when that happened, because by that time Gene was playing drums and actually was touring with Les and Mary. They went all over Germany at the time.
Yeah, and is the Paul family still involved in the foundation's work, Sue?
Not directly. Les had five kids. Russ, whose legal name was Les Paul Jr., and here's a funny bit of trivia, Les never legally changed his name. So the real Les Paul was Les's oldest son. And he was called Rusty, and Russ has passed. Gene Paul is the second son, and I certainly have become friends with Gene, as has everybody in the Les Paul Foundation. And he helps us out. He gives us information and vice versa. And then there is, Les and Mary had a baby girl who died, which Les had said was the worst day of his life. And then they adopted a girl, and her name is Colleen, and she is alive and lives in California, and we get along great with her, too, and she likes what we are doing. And then, as often happens, right after Les and Mary adopted Colleen, surprise, Mary got pregnant, and so there's Bobby. There's a fun piece of trivia that I wanted to share with your listeners, and that is, I think most people know what the Capitol Record building in Hollywood looks like.
Yep, the round one?
But I bet you didn't know is that Les designed the echo chambers that are used today that are underneath the parking lot at that building.
What are the echo chambers below the Capitol Records building in Hollywood?
Yeah. They're used for recording.
Oh.
They're used today for recording. When an artist wants to have an echo effect, they use the echo chambers that Les Paul designed in 1952.
Wow.
And it was interesting because someone had said that to me, and I was putting together the information on Les's inventions and innovations, and I wanted to make really, really sure that before I said it, that I knew it was accurate. And so I started calling people at Capitol Records and Hollywood, Hollywood Architectural Organization. And what I was connected, and this is amazing, I connected with the designer of that building. And I thought, my gosh,
wow. The
man must be 150 years old. he was an intern when he designed that building. And he said to me, not only did Les design the echo chambers, he designed the original recording studios at Capitol Records.
Unbelievable. That is some trivia, because I had no idea. I don't know where else that would be written or documented. That's amazing.
On our website.
Les-Paul.com. And our last minute, Sue Baker, how does Waukesha remember its own Les Paul?
We have the Les Paul Parkway that encircles Waukesha. There's a Les Paul Middle School. There's a Les Paul Performance Center. Gibson gifted 10-foot guitars that are painted and all over the city. Yep, Les is everywhere.
Sue Baker, it has been a pleasure to be able to hear some of the stories, some of your experiences, and the life of Les Paul. The fact that he is the only person inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and the National Inventors Hall of Fame, and that he came from right here in our own backyard. I can't thank you enough, Sue, for the work you're doing at the foundation and sharing it with us today. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Sue Baker is the program director at the Les Paul Foundation. And coming up after the news, we're going to hear how a Wisconsin-based Eagles cover band is replicating the band's experience. Now, if you wanted to see the Eagles today, you'd have to go all the way to Las Vegas. You'd be paying hundreds of dollars for the privilege. And or perhaps maybe you could just go to Lake Geneva and pay a fraction of the cost. That's next after the news here on The Larry Miller Show. I'm in for Larry today. He returns tomorrow on Garden Talk right here on WPR News.
Vaya con Dios, my love. Wherever you may be, I'll be beside you. Although your many million dreams away. Each night
the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Larry today, and that's the Eagles. It's the Eagles, right? We're all singing along to Peaceful Easy Feeling, but it's not the Eagles, because that's live right here in our own backyard in Wisconsin with Take It Easy, an Eagles tribute band that performs around the state. And our next guest is the vocalist and guitarist for Take It Easy, Chris Boyden. And as we talk with Chris, we invite you to the conversation. We all have our favorites, so it's your opportunity to tell us your favorite cover band and what it is that makes them so special, whether it's the band's music that they cover, or how well they cover it, whether it's the fact that the lead singer actually looks like the lead singer or their voices are right on the spot. Who's your favorite cover band around Wisconsin and why? It's time to give them a shout out this morning. And what are your questions for someone who plays live music for a living and a crowd? 800-642-1234 to join our show, 800-642-1234, or email talk@wpr.org anytime. Chris Boyden, welcome to the Larry Mueller Show.
Hey, thank you.
So I'm wondering from your perspective as a guitarist and vocalist for Take It Easy, the Eagles tribute band in Wisconsin, what does it take to make a good tribute band, to make a great tribute band?
Well, I think that most importantly is to perform the music, respective to the original artist, really get accurate and articulate, try to make it sound like you're actually listening to the original artist, whether that be a live performance or the studio recordings. Second to that would be the image you want to portray. You want to look like you really come from that era. If you're playing a band from the 70s, you want to look like you could have been that band from the 70s. Taking it to the extreme, if you're covering Kiss, you need to put on the makeup.
Yes, you do.
Blow some stuff up.
How did Chris Boyden end up in Take It Easy, the Eagles tribute band?
Well, a friend of mine, John Harrison, called one day and said, what do you think about doing a tribute to the Eagles? Well, I thought, that's a tall order. A lot of vocals, a lot of guitars.
Harmonies.
The harmonies, So we dove into it and just had so much fun putting the project together that it became a mainstay for us.
Well, yeah, Chris, you've got this amazing catalog to choose from. But when you talk about what makes a good tribute band, you're talking about matching the look and the era. But the Eagles, they transcend eras. I mean, they're over generations at this point and still playing, with Vince Gill sitting in for the late Glenn Frey in Las Vegas, hosting a residency at the new Sphere right now. So how do you go over the generations from the original Take It Easy off their first album to Seven Bridges Road?
How do you bridge that?
Yeah, those generations.
I mean, it's really just a matter of studying the material and performing it to the best of your ability. Try to really pull off that feel of what it would be like to actually go to an Eagles concert.
That's right, and that's why people go to tribute bands, right? Is to get that peaceful, easy feeling.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. Chris, when did you first join a band? How did you get started in being a musician, which I think to some degree everybody in radio has dreamed about doing at one point or another?
Holy cow, that goes back a while. junior high school probably is the first band that we actually had together, and just going along and figuring it out. Do the best you can to figure it out. Get out there and perform. Keep practicing and keep getting yourself out.
What were some of the names of, do you remember some of the names of your bands back in the day?
there were many. probably one of the bigger ones was the band Quarantine. That was an early kind of a heavy-edged metal band. Mostly Water was the one that I've had together since the 80s.
Wow.
Kind of a variety group. But then, about 20 years ago when we started doing the tributes, we started a tribute to the Eagles, Take It Easy, of course. Mm-hmm. Hypnotized, the music of Fleetwood Mac. We now released a Supertramp tribute.
Wow.
We've done a Leonard Skinner tribute show called Gimme Skinner. And
Freebird!
Playing, Playing it, yeah, exactly. Play it. Now we can really we can offer that when people call out "Play Freebird," we really do.
you can hit that request. That's nice, Chris.
Yeah, exactly.
So, as you mentioned, so there is a Fleetwood Mac tribute band. There is a Supertramp tribute band, some Skynyrd as well, and this is all part of the Milwaukee-based Impact Music Group online at impactmusic.group. So, tell us, I mean, how is it as making a living and doing as a business? You're living as a musician. You're making a living as a musician, Chris. So I got to believe that's fulfilling a dream of yours that goes all the way back to junior high.
It really is. It really is. And I feel blessed. There's so much talent in this area in Wisconsin, and, you know, people who just really believe in the arts, in entertainment, you know, in performing and celebrating each other's talents and, abilities. And that goes right along with the audience being able to fill up a theater with 800 people and having their undivided attention. It's just really goes well beyond the financial reward.
Well, and so what's it like? Because the tribute bands, they're largely not going to be in the studio trying to recreate the music. They're on stage with a live audience trying to recreate that experience. So what's the feedback loop like between a tribute band and the audience on the other side?
Yeah, that's huge. That's probably, I mean, you touched on one of the main rewards, in my opinion, is getting up there and performing this stuff and having the audience react. And, you know, I mean, it's not music that we wrote. So it's, right. there's a disconnect a little bit there with the artistic part of it, but there's the reward of they're receiving, you know, they're receiving that, the work that you put in to replicate what the Eagles or Fleetwood Mac had put out. And, you know, one of my first memories is I'm going into a guitar solo and the whole front row is singing the guitar solo. You could see their heads going up and down and side to side, and you could see that they know these tunes. They know them really well, and I better get them right.
Well, exactly. The expectations are, I would imagine, a little higher than they were for quarantine. But on the other hand, I would imagine that it's a lot easier for folks to sing along to the Eagles than it was for them to sing along with quarantine.
Something that they didn't know, sure. Music that they weren't familiar with. Yeah.
So have you seen the popularity of these tribute bands growing, or has it been pretty stable? I know other touring acts have really struggled post-pandemic, that the economics are not easy, but it's always rewarding and worthwhile because of the experience of sharing your music and having that feedback loop. So what's the business of these tribute bands like, Chris?
Interestingly, post-pandemic things just took off. They really seemed to pick up in a big way. Kind of reflecting on that, about maybe 20 years ago was my first experience with the tribute scene, and that was with Elvis tribute artist Tony Rocker.
Sure.
He had the Elvis show, and I thought, well, that sounds interesting, and I joined on with guitar on that one, and it was a blast. It was really fun to be a part of the show, and then I started thinking, you know, this tribute thing dates way back into the 70s when with all the Elvis impersonators, and then over the last, I guess, just the past 10 years, it's blown up, you know, even people who are just brand new, Taylor Swift and Chris Stapleton, they have tribute artists out there doing their work and doing really well. So people are embracing the ability to go and see these performances. They're more like a play than just going out to see a band, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting.
So it really, it's really quite popular, and, you know, you're just kind of seeing them pop up all over the place with different, you know, my favorite band, someone would say, is Alice in Chains. So they start a grunge or Alice in Chains, tribute, and they find their following, you know, their friends, and it just builds from there.
Do you ever hit up a tribute band just to see or compare and contrast?
Well, I think we do a bit of that. We watch and we support each other. We, yeah. You know, one of my favorite things to do, and we do this a couple times a year, is to do like a tribute fest. So, you know, us and some friends of ours, and you know, maybe 5 or 6 tribute bands come together. And for me, I always say, you know, this is my opportunity to watch them, because they're playing and I want to go see them, and they're doing well, but I'm also out playing, so I don't get a chance to see their show much. So just this past weekend, I was able to see the 52nd Street, the Billy Joel tribute, and the Taylor Swift and Huey Lewis, and, you know, all these other tributes that we played with. On that night, it was a blast.
Yeah, that sounds like a heck of a lineup. It sounds like a festival lineup. Like you could be doing Coachella for the tribute bands.
Yeah,
Chris, you got shows coming up between now and the new year?
Well, we do. We have, if you want to catch one of our shows, of course, you can go to impactmusic.group/calendar to see our full schedule. But this weekend, the Supertramp tribute will be playing at Shank Hall. That's November 23rd. So Shank Hall in Milwaukee. And then coming up December 14th, you can catch the Fleetwood Mac and Eagles show. We do a Hypnotized Take It Easy double bill. So you get 2 for the price of 1 at Sharon Wilson Center in Brookfield.
All right. So you've got, what made you decide to be to try out a Supertramp tribute band? Do they have ties to the Midwest here?
You know, they do. The Supertramp came around here quite a bit, even back in the 70s. I haven't verified this yet, but I hear that one of their biggest promoters was actually from the Midwest, I believe the Northern Illinois area. So he brought them here quite a bit. Apparently they played Alpine Valley a lot. And we've gone and seen Roger Hodgson at the Pottawatomie at the Northern Lights Casino.
Sure.
Couple times, but I missed my opportunity to catch the full band.
Are there other bands that the Impact Music Group has considered creating a tribute for? I mean, Rockford's own Cheap Trick, perhaps, or how about the Violent Femmes from Milwaukee?
Well, a couple of good ideas. I think right now we've got a pretty good roster going with the three that we have running.
Sure.
With that, and I also work for hire with Feels Like the First Time with their America's Foreigner tribute. So I got my hands pretty full right now to start up a new one, but never say never, right?
Well, let me reintroduce you. Chris Boyden is with the Impact Music Group. He is a vocalist and guitarist with Take It Easy, the Eagles tribute band, who'll be on a double bill, and I believe that was in Brookfield December 14th, Chris?
That's right.
And if you'd like to give a shout out to your favorite tribute band, now is the time to do it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email talk@wpr.org. I mean, when I listen to the Eagles, I am hearing these perfect harmonies. I am hearing these guitar parts that I am sure took months to work out in the studio and fine-tune. In fact, that's part of the legend and the lore of the Eagles, right? Is how, and Fleetwood Mac, for that matter, is how locked up they got in those studios. So how much work is this for you compared to the pleasure of the reward of playing it? How much do you have to put in to make those sounds spot on, Chris?
Oh, yeah, lots of work. You know, there's a term called woodshedding. We lock ourselves in the basement and we practice and we listen. And we, you know, I like to record myself and then listen back. Oh, I probably could do that better, you know. We have rehearsals, weekly rehearsals, where we get together and we'll do sectionals, we'll do vocals. We're just going to work on vocals today. And the four of us will get together and, you know, the Eagles call it the circle of fear. You get together and you face each other and you sing your heart out. And, you know, we go back and we listen and, oh, that's not good enough, guys. Let's try it again, you know. And each one of us holds the other accountable, which is a really nice, powerful thing that, you know, we're all listening and we're, you know, we want this to be spot on. I mean, Eagles are so great.
Yes.
They just got it together. And so if we can come close, if we got people telling us afterwards it was like being at a real Eagles show, then there's the smiles.
Yeah, is that the greatest compliment you can receive when you were, you know, playing some of the music of the greats? Is that, you know, you can close your eyes and pretty much be there from 30 years ago? What's the response like from your crowd?
That's spot on. You know, coming out and telling us it was like being at the real show. Mm-hmm. That, you know, it feels great. You know, people have said, "Well, you brought tears to my eyes." You know, it felt so emotional, and so you guys are really having fun up there and believing in it. You know, you need the stories. So, you know, people come out and say, "Oh, we saw Supertramp at Alpine Valley three times." We, you know, "Oh, I met my husband at an Eagles concert," and you know, things like that. And everybody comes out of there with something in mind that they want to share with us, and that to me is it's moving.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, it provokes
it's
a story.
One thing to be up there performing this stuff, and that's emotional for us. But
sure,
then to be out at the meet and greet afterwards and seeing people that, you know, they want to come up and they want to shake your hand and they want to tell you their story, now we know we hit home.
Yeah. Chris Boyden from the tribute band Take It Easy joining us, also taking your favorite tribute bands around Wisconsin at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Phyllis in Winona. Hi, Phyllis.
Hi there. I would like to recommend Steely Dane out of Madison. I've seen them twice, and they are awesome. They come
with all
the backup, you know, the saxophonists and doo-wop girls and the whole thing, and I love Steely Dan, and these guys really knock it out of the park.
That's incredible, Phyllis, because I think of Steely Dan as a very intricate, complicated musically, that, you know, different rhythms. I would think this would be almost an incredible challenge to even learn their music. But the fact that Steely Dan's doing it out of Madison, I appreciate the shout-out, Phyllis. Chris, I'll ask you, as a guitarist and singer, could you imagine learning some of the Steely Dan catalog? That would be a challenge and a half.
Really intense. Really intense stuff. Yeah.
Because it's like progressive rock, and it's not your traditional three-chord Monty that, you know, most music's built around.
Yep, prog rock at its finest.
Absolutely. Steely Dan out of Madison. I will have to look them up, close my eyes, and see how it matches up. And I appreciate the call, Phyllis. So what's next for Chris Boyden then, as you look towards the shows coming up here in Brookfield and Schenck Hall in Milwaukee? How do you plan your future with these bands, Chris?
Well, we just keep on practicing, the stuff, and we'll do the show, and then we'll look back at the recording. You know, we video the show and watch and say, what can we do different? You know, there's even something as small as there's an area of the stage that we could probably put a prop that would really, you know, deliver a message that would bring something home. For instance, the Supertramp tribute, we have a big yellow umbrella that we bring out to match their one of their album covers or a show that they did once, you know, and the lounge chair. So we actually set up a place for that, and that's all part of it too, you know. When people look and they see an album cover, you know, that's from that album or that show we saw. So we do a lot of that. At 2025 is full of those ideas. What can we do? Can we, you know, get the video wall? Can we, you know, get into this theater? They're bringing back this vintage theater. Let's get in there.
Yeah.
Have we been in Wausau yet? You know, so stuff like that. We just keep thinking of what we can do there and keeping it fun. We try not to take it too seriously. You know,
when you talk about it, Chris, and my first question was, what makes a successful tribute band? And as you talk about the attention to detail that goes into the harmonies, the musical parts for each instrument, even the staging and how the stage is set, it really seems to come down to the attention to detail makes that tribute band, you know, connect with that audience.
That's for sure.
Always curious about this. Hear a lot about work-life balance for people who have to go to the office from 9 to 5. But what's like work-life balance like for a guy who's got to go on stage from 9 at night until 2 in the morning?
Oh yeah. Well, yeah. I did that for years and years in my youth, and I don't know. I'm currently retired from the construction industry and doing music full time. So I don't know that I could do both.
So it works out, and it's just life. That's how you balance that.
I'm in five groups at the moment, so that's my trade-off, you know. But some of our guys aren't. They're in the one band, or maybe two, and that leaves time for work. And I think there's a nice balance that they have where they enjoy what they do at work, and they come home and they're, I wouldn't call it a hobby. It's very serious, but it's their release. It's their escape from that day to day. So.
Yeah, and I think everybody who plays a musical instrument on the side can relate to that. It is a release. It is an expression, and it is an opportunity to just be. I really appreciate your perspective, and I guess I had no idea that you retired from the construction industry. So how long have you been doing this music? About as long as the Eagles now?
Well, no, not quite that long yet. Not quite that long yet, but I would say if I went all the way back to my first experience with the Elvis, would be 20 years.
Wow.
The Eagles is 10 years now. And,
wow.
And Fleetwood Mac is about 5 years. And so, you know, they're just, I never even think about it, really. I just going along and trying to do the best I can and enjoy the ride.
Chris Boyden, looking forward to seeing you out and about with any number of your musical acts. And I want to thank you for sharing your experience with these tribute bands with all of us this afternoon. Thanks for joining us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me.
You bet. Chris Boyden is with the Impact Music Group out of Milwaukee, online at impactmusic.group, where you'll find a calendar of the tribute bands, Take It Easy, the Eagles tribute band, Fleetwood Mac cover band, Supertramp cover band, and then there was the Journey cover band, too. Covered them all with our guest, Chris Boyden, and I thank him for the experience, and looking forward to checking out Steely Dan around Madison when I get a chance to see if they can match up. Now, coming up next, Lou Ray, a musician with roots in Eau Claire, joins us to take a look at the writing process, the music business, and how to break through with beautiful music, and we invite you to the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. But we'll go out with a little more Take It Easy, the Eagles tribute band. This is The Best of My Love. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today on WPR News. That's the music of Lou Ray, musician with roots in Eau Claire. You're listening to her track called Unwritten. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today on The Larry Mueller Show. And Lou Ray joins us now. And if you haven't heard her music before and you were just wondering why, it's worth asking. Shannon Carey performs under the name Lou Ray. She's a singer-songwriter from Wisconsin. Lou Ray recorded her second full-length album, Dig, in Eau Claire. Are you a musician with Wisconsin roots? Share your story about what it takes to make it and tell us how you support music in your community. Join our conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And Shannon, welcome to The Larry Mueller Show.
Hi.
Thank you so much
for having me.
Your music is beautiful. How come I've never heard it before?
Thank you.
I just loved listening to your album, and people can find it on Bandcamp and listen at their leisure, and I'd encourage them to do so. And I was like, this is right here from our own backyard. How did I miss this?
Well, you know, that I don't know the full answer.
But, well, yeah, because it's me. But you've got some beautiful music, Shannon, and you perform under the name Lou Ray, and you're from Wisconsin, and you recorded your second album in Eau Claire. I just feel like people should know that, and they should, because they love the music. What's it take to get your music out there, I guess, is the question I'd have for you.
Well, right now, I think my thought is, since I'm back in Wisconsin, to just start playing out more and kind of getting the word out here, but I was living in Richmond, Virginia, for the past like 7 or 8 years before this. And that's kind of in D.C. and Virginia is where I wrote the songs and started playing out and having a band. And then I toured in Wisconsin like a tiny bit, but I think it's just it's a lot harder than it seems to get music heard. And it was just a process to get as far as with the two albums that I was able to get. But now I'm feeling like it's more about just locally, like what can I do to connect with people here and expose, you know, my songs and try to play more.
Absolutely. And I'd like to just listen to a little bit more to your music from her last album. And Shannon, our guest, performs under the name Lou Ray, and we'll ask her about that. But let's hear a little more from the title track of her most recent album, Dig. Shannon, your album speaks to me, and it seems like it comes from a very personal place for you.
Yes. Well, first off, I'm at this point in my life with music that I'm more surprised when people do hear it, and I'm just really grateful that you did and that you connect with it. I mean, I think that when I wrote it, I still feel like writing songs is just the way that I best express myself. And yeah, it's just a way that, you know, I was going through the end of a relationship with that song. And so the album's kind of about that, but I feel like it grows with me. Like I can see, you know, songs have more meaning than just one thing. Like it can be kind of like themes that you've had in your life and like how they come about at different times.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And so what does Eau Claire have? How does Eau Claire define the music of Lou Ray? What's the connection there?
Well, my brother is Sean Carey, and he plays in Bon Iver, if you've heard of that band. And so my brothers both went to school here, and they stayed. And so we're from Wisconsin. I'm from Lake Geneva, so that's like closer to Chicago. Yeah. And went to Madison and then Milwaukee for undergrad. And then I kind of moved around after that. And then my brother stayed here and Sean became a musician. And then, you know, later I was in my late 20s and I decided to learn banjo. And then I started to kind of think about what it would be like to write songs and play music. And Sean was just very encouraging and he helped me, you know, with all of it.
And Bon Iver really has been a part of a music scene in Eau Claire that's blown up with its own, at least for a few years before the pandemic, its own music festival. I just think that there is a culture of music there, of creation, of expression that invites people to actually come there, to come to Eau Claire and let's hear you sing.
Yes, and I've been so pleased so far. So we've been here a year and a half in Eau Claire, and the community has been just so welcoming. It's been really much more than I expected, and you know we've just managed to be introduced to people and starting to play more things with people and get to know the musicians here. So that's just so great.
Our guest is Shannon Carey. She performs under the name Lou Ray, and she's out of Eau Claire. And you can find her. She's performing coming up here December 12th at Shift in Eau Claire. If you are interested, you can find out more about her online from her website, louraymusic.com. Let's go to Jerry in Shell Lake. Jerry, good afternoon.
Hi, I'd like to ask Lou if she's part of the folk string music scene in the Midwest going on all over the place right now, and bluegrass, of course. And I think it's more of a cutting edge than our most of our pop music these days.
Very interesting, and I do believe some Billy Strings fans would agree with you, Jerry. And so you talked about Shannon starting out with or learning the banjo. How has folk and bluegrass and that scene here in our backyard defined your work?
Well, that is something I need to learn more about, and I would love to be more connected to that community. The people here that I know are Courtney Hartman is a fabulous guitarist and singer, and then Shane Leonard also plays a lot of acoustic instruments and bluegrass. But I don't know a lot of others, and I would love to just meet more people and jam and play that part of the banjo, which I kind of do my own thing with Lou Ray, but I also like to just play more traditional stuff with people.
Now, you perform under the name Lou Ray, L-U-R-A-Y, and it's all one word, and I'm wondering where that name came from.
It comes from a town in Virginia that's sort of in the Blue Ridge Mountains outside of D.C., and it was just a place where I was writing some of those first songs from my first album, and one of the songs I named after it, and then I just decided to just name the whole thing after that. I just felt like... I like the way it sounded, and it's a beautiful place, and I think it just connects a little bit with what I was feeling at the time, and just stuck with it.
You, your music is very personal. It is obviously heartfelt, and it comes from a place that, I would imagine would be a challenge to put out there and share. When you write something that is so close to you, how hard is it to put it out there and let people judge it, listen to it or talk over it while you're trying to perform it? What's it like putting it out there, and what would you say to people who have trouble, who have things that they would like to express, but have a fear of putting it out there?
I think exposure kind of helps with that. Like the first time you play a song, it is very raw. I did that recently, played a couple new songs, and it's almost hard to get through it. But then once you start doing it a few times, it starts to feel better, and it starts to feel like a little bit more comfortable. But I think it's just a matter of doing it. Like I was thinking back to open mics. That was one of the first things I did. And it's just getting that experience. But I think it is one of the special things. Like you create this thing and then you get to show it to people, and you want to also make sure it's not too personal. Make sure you're comfortable with what you're going to share.
Absolutely. But at the same time, when you share it and then it has that sort of emotional response that seems to match the emotions that you created it with, I can't imagine that would, to me, seem like why you do what you do.
Yeah, it's amazing. Mm-hmm. No, I mean, I love it. I love the performing part of it. And, playing a new song or playing a song people seem to really connect with, it is very validating, because you're like, yes, this is like one of those emotions that we all feel, and I'm trying to put it into words or make it be expressed with music.
I have another song of yours that I'd like to play from Lou Ray's latest album, Dig. This is Fire Sale.
All my best possessions, but the going is for the overspend. Taking our time with the same expressions at a coffee cup as a promise. Take the long way as is our way. Even rains on us, we'll laugh it up. Take the long way, we'll spell things up. We'll make days for us, we'll drag it.
Wow. I just think that is beautiful. And that's Fire Sale from Lou Ray, which is the performer's name of our guest, Shannon Carey. And you can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. Musical artist in Wisconsin looking to break through. What do you do? 800-642-1234 is the number to join us. And Shannon, you talked about your brother helping you with this record. He's also featured on this song, as I understand it. What's it like working with your brother on music?
Well, you know, since I've moved here, we kind of been doing our own things, but when I'm working on a record, it's been really fun because I send him the songs and then he kind of adds things and has ideas. And then when we were in the studio, we just try things out. And some of the stuff he just messes around with and sends me, or some of it we'll work on together. But it's really cool because I think he has a way of adding like the environment to a song. Like I'm like the person that writes the lyrics and the melody and everything. And like with that song, I mean, it's so much his touches, I think, that make that song really special. Like the way that it sounds when you listen to the recording. Mm.
Yeah, I to me, like, I hear Eau Claire in there, like the Bon Iver feel, and it comes from your brother, and you can almost feel the sound of Eau Claire, and all of a sudden, you know, this Wisconsin area has a music scene that actually has a sound almost of its own?
It's cool how much it's touched, for sure. Like, it's really been influential on a lot of artists.
Right, putting Eau Claire on the map, which is, I think, very cool as well. Our guest is Shannon Carey. She performs under the name Lou Ray, and she's got a show coming up December 12th at Shift, the Coffee House in Eau Claire, and our conversation with her continues. Let's hear a little more music if we can, because that's the magic in this life. The Wilder, play that from Lou Ray. As we go out here, I'm Lee Rayburn, filling in for Larry Mueller, and you're listening to WPR News.
Is there anyone who knows the places we go and we met? And the world that we know reminds me of
just wanted to feature music from our guest today. That's Lou Ray with Mountain on WPR News. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today. He returns tomorrow for Garden Talk, and our guest tomorrow on Garden Talk is Mark Dwyer, who's back to help us care for our plants as winter weather arrives, and we're going to build a better compost tomorrow as well. That's Garden Talk every Friday from 11 to 1 here on WPR News. But right now, our guest, Shannon Carey, she performs as Lou Ray and will be performing December 12th at Shift in Eau Claire, where she has returned after a handful of years out in Virginia in the D.C. area. And Shannon, I wanted to ask you about the mountain and this song about the reason for the mountain. It isn't mine to know. I'm still thinking about that line. And somehow, you know, I can see Lou Ray, Virginia in that line.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's about just nature being there for its own sake and not for our sake, but that we can, we can touch the sacredness of life through being in nature.
The moths, the lightning bugs, and the big mountain.
Yeah.
That's an interesting contrast from these little tiny things that light up our nights to these big monstrosities in our background and how they all are a part of what inspires you. What are your influences? Like, what did you grow up listening to, and what do you still have on heavy rotation?
Well, I feel like a lot of stuff from the 70s and 80s was stuff that I listened to and I still like. But I was thinking about that. I listen to Anais Mitchell a lot nowadays, like in terms of like a person who's doing great things now. But I grew up listening to like James Taylor, Linda Ronstadt, Emmylou Harris, Phil Collins.
Genesis. Sure. No, you don't have to laugh at that. Come on.
Yeah, all that stuff. Like, you know, the good stuff. Peter Gabriel, Kate Bush.
Well, I know Anais Mitchell from Bonnie Light Horseman, which is one of her groups with the Fruit Bats, I believe, and the Shins. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a super group. But, yeah, I can totally hear that music. And you'd mentioned that you were writing some new songs now, Lou Ray. Tell us a little bit about your process and where this new music is coming from for you.
Well, I am in a song group, which is like a 20 or more musicians who write songs and submit them to each other. And I've been doing that for years, and that helps me write nowadays. So I have two little kids now, and I have limited time to write. But usually if I am going to write, it's on one day a week where they're not here, and I can often use the prompt of our song group. So it's like somebody leads it and they send out the week's prompt, and then you write a song with that word in it. So that's been one of the really cool ways that I've been writing songs, and it just helps you kind of think about things differently. And you can still write about what's going on with you, but you kind of have like a grain of an idea from that.
Interesting, Shannon, because talk about, you know, the challenge of putting yourself out there and you know, your self-expression for others to view and review and, you know, do what they will with it. But this song group seems like an incredibly, I don't know, a safe place to start with your expression and putting it out there and having a feedback that is supportive, that is constructive, that is yes and also to some degree internal, so that you don't have to worry if you put, I don't know, a bad song. I don't think there's such thing as a bad song, or a song that just doesn't connect, you know, before you try it with a big crowd.
Definitely. Yeah, it's good. It definitely taught me to write bad songs, because when I started the group, I would be like doing all the different tracks and layers, and I would do like this completed thing, which is cool. But now it's more just like a voice memo version, you know, where you get the idea and then you can decide if you want to perform that, or you want to build that, or you want to just be like, that was just that.
Shannon Carey, what's the importance of writing a bad song?
Well, because it still feels good to write it, even though it's not something you'll perform, because there's still something in there that you needed to get out. And plus, it shows you that you don't have to write the perfect song. You know, you just write a song.
It doesn't have to be a masterpiece every time. And those that wrote the masterpieces did so because they wrote hundreds and hundreds of other songs that are in their catalog. Or at least that seems to be the general going, generalizing there, but that seems to be my experience. And that song group, how do you get involved in a song group? For musicians that are like, oh man, I would go to an open mic night if I had a little bit of, you know, a pat on the back. How do you even find these groups of musicians?
That I don't know. I really don't.
I think
this was just so random. It was like I played with another musician who had just heard about it, and then I was able to join. But I think going to things like the Folk Alliance, they do a lot of like, so that's like a national thing. But whenever you get together with a lot of musicians, I feel like that's where these things can be discovered, like people have their own little groups and stuff.
Sure. So being among other musicians, not necessarily performing out with other musicians, but just hanging out with a group and seeing where they're going and where they get their inspiration and support from. And where, I mean, you're raising two kids. Where do you get your support from, Shannon? How are you able to continue as a musician?
Well, I think that's the question, just in terms of like, how do you fit it all in? And that's why there's been less performing on my part since I had the two. But my husband plays with me. He's plays guitar. So that can be a little challenging. If we're going to play together, then we need to get either family or a babysitter. So, yeah.
It takes a village for these two to be able to play together.
Kind of, yeah.
How many new songs do you have? And do you have any plans for returning to the studio, perhaps with your brother and putting them down on tape?
Yes, I definitely do. I don't know when, but there's plenty for an album. I think it would just be, you know, picking a time and doing it. And that would, I feel like having places to play will help motivate the next record, because you kind of just need, you know, you need a place to do the music and people to come. And I think it's all kind of like connected. And like, once you kind of get off the train, you got to figure out how to get back on the train. And that would be helpful.
Yeah,
I did record.
But you make a great point. As you perform as Lou Ray out there, it is, I would imagine, putting music out in front of an audience to see how it is received is probably more effective than just putting it online and seeing if anybody listens.
Definitely.
Yeah, and this is part of the how do you break through when you have music that I would like to share your music with everybody, but how do you break through all the noise that this world has to find a beautiful song? And there's not an easy answer to that, but it's not.
No.
You certainly have to look. I've got John here in northern Wisconsin. John, thanks for joining us today. You're on the air with Shannon Carey.
Hi. Yeah, I'm a musician myself and a songwriter and writing all sorts of different genres. And I just wanted to say I heard some of the music and I really like the melodic lines and really nice music. And wish you good luck on your gig.
Yeah, John, where are you playing next?
Oh, my. Let's see. I just got done with a show on Saturday. It sold out, actually, so I was really excited about that. And I could even give the venue for her to play at a future date. It's a great place to play.
Go ahead.
I don't know if that's possible. Oh, it's Wusso's Concert Cafe in Duluth, Minnesota.
Ah.
I'm going to write it down.
It was what Concert Cafe in Duluth?
Place. Yeah, he's a really, Jason Wusso, he owns it. He's a really great guy, great promoter of all sorts of music.
Yeah, you've got a scene up there in Duluth too with some great local music.
Oh my word!
Yeah.
Oh yeah, that's something to check out.
Duluth is worth checking out. And John, I appreciate the input. And then again, it goes back to how we started the conversation, Shannon, is that I think your music deserves to be heard. I just don't know how it breaks through all the noise that we have in this world today. This world could use a little more beautiful music, a little more harmony.
Well, thank you. Yeah. I mean, I keep at it. I think social media is one of the things that I struggle with, that I think if I put that out more, it would help. But I think, you know, it's kind of just like it's hard for your mental health sometimes to be doing a lot of that. So
yeah, especially
always a challenge
when you're putting yourself out there, not a character or a personality, but an actual genuine person. And those to me would be the ones you would want to seek out through all the noise and find and listen to. So Shannon, as we're wrapping up here, for those who, again, want to put their music, have something to say, but, you know, are drowned out by the noise or are worried about taking that next step and putting it in front of a crowd and letting them judge it, what tips do you have for someone who wants to do music, who wants to put out an album, who wants to perform live?
I think just making yourself do it the first time and just seeing what happens and having that feeling in the room and connecting with the people. And then that kind of builds because you meet people and then more shows come out of that. And I think just taking the first step is probably the biggest thing.
Shannon Carey, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. And I'll invite everybody to see Shannon Carey perform as Lou Ray, December 12th at The Shift in Eau Claire. Shannon, thank you so much.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you, listening to the music and reaching out.
Feeling the music and to some degree, singing along or humming along. And We'll wrap up our day, our show today, with a little more music from our guest, Lou Ray. The song, Unwritten. And a reminder that tomorrow on Garden Talk during the Larry Mueller Show, Mark Dwyer is back to help you care for your plants. And we'll talk about composting. It's tomorrow from 11 to 1 right here on WPR News.